Welcome back to another week on the Jolly Swagman podcast. I'm Joe.
I'm Angus.
And this is your podcast on uncommon topics with exceptional guests. We are putting aside our property series for now, and we're going back to our bread and butter. This week, uncovering China's secret campaign to influence Australian politics and culture.
James Leibold, Associate Professor at La Trobe University, is warning about a growing network of unofficial lobbyists and activists around the country who are reporting directly back to the Chinese Communist Party. He says this is something that we need to be concerned about. The Attorney General, George Brandis, introduced a bill into the Australian Parliament last week banning foreign donations and setting up a US-style register of foreign agents. So this is definitely a problem that all levels of government are dealing with, and it's something we think that you should be knowing about.
Of course, we love the Chinese people and we love China, but this is a podcast about the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda and its tactics, turning its machine of propaganda from the domestic arena to other countries around the world. And why are we talking about this now? Well, we've seen things happen that point to China's covert influence. Only a week ago, Clive Hamilton had his book about China pulled by Allen & Unwin Publishing because they were afraid of court cases brought by the Chinese Communist Party. So while it's not at a point where we should be running for the hills, it's certainly something that we don't want to sleepwalk into a situation where we realize that China has exerted more control over our politics in Australia than we would care to happen.
And just think about that, everyone, for a moment. Allen & Unwin, a global publishing house, is now self-censoring against criticizing China. So we've got to a point now where our academics and our institutions are too afraid to speak out about the growing threat, which is why it's important to distinguish criticisms of the Chinese Communist Party with the Chinese people. That's something that James is very particular on. It's very important to make that distinction before we jump into this discussion, which we hope that you enjoy.
So without much further ado,
hit it.
All the way from their Sydney studio, you're listening to the Jolly Swagmen, the podcast on unusual topics with exceptional guests, with your hosts, Angus and Joe.
James Leibold, thank you for joining us on the Jolly Swagmen podcast.
Great to be with you both, Joe and Angus.
So maybe we can start by setting the scene for the current situation and the extent of Chinese influence in Australia. Could you maybe explain to us and our listeners the extent of the overt and covert influence that they currently have?
Yeah, I think it's really important to begin with a subtle but important distinction before we talk about this, you know, rather sensitive topic. I think that distinction is between the influence of China or the Chinese people and the influence of the Chinese Communist Party. You know, China and the Chinese people have long made a wonderful contribution to human history. They continue to do that. You know, 5,000 years of written history, a whole range of wonderful inventions that were on display at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And they continue to contribute handsomely to the world's prosperity and our prosperity here in Australia. What I'm concerned of, and several of my colleagues, is about the actions of the Chinese Communist Party and its agents, both inside China and increasingly abroad. Now, let's not forget, and I think it's really important to point out at the very beginning, that that China is a repressive, authoritarian, one-party state, which rules with an iron grip over its 1.3 billion population in China. And under its current leader, Xi Jinping, it's become increasingly repressive both at home and abroad. Give just a few examples in China. You know, they're locking up human rights lawyers. They're kidnapping booksellers from Hong Kong. They're surveilling and persecuting their minorities and religious believers. And they even locked up a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Liu Xiaobo, and allowed him to die in prison simply because he put forward a different political point of view. And now that, you know, that repression is being exported abroad and China's trying to recast its image in places like Australia. And so we have a whole range of examples of that now. Just briefly, I'll mention four, and we can, if you want to, unpack some of them. But four examples of CCP influence here in Australia. First is the kind of co-opting and manipulating of the overseas Chinese community here. Second, seeking to influence our political process through both political donations as well as running pro-CCP candidates in local elections. It's certainly using now its considerable economic leverage over Australia to try to encourage more accommodation of China's foreign policy interests, such as asking us to join the Belt and Road Initiative or not to conduct freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea. And then finally, it's also using its leverage in our university systems to try to reshape the narrative about China's rise, as well as drawing upon the talent of our researchers and our taxpayer money to try to advance China's economic and political interests. So those are four of the ones that come to my mind, but each of those, of course, could be unpacked even further.
James, I remember a speech Malcolm Turnbull gave when he was opposition leader. We can put a link to this in the show notes for anyone interested. But in the speech, he argued that we shouldn't underestimate the fact that China has never had a history of imperialism. They're not interested in exporting their ideology across the world and to other countries. Has that assumption now been overturned, or do their actions still fall short of imperialist belligerence?
Well, I think it depends how you define imperialism, both in the kind of historical context as well as the modern context. I mean, I don't agree with Malcolm Turnbull on that one. Certainly, if you look at Chinese history, there have been periods of time where it was a kind of an expansionist continental power, where it expanded its reach not only into places like Tibet and Xinjiang and Mongolia, but all the way into Central Asia. There are other times when it kind of drew back in behind the Great Wall and even cut off its kind of maritime access. China's power over the course of the last five millennia has waxed and waned at periods of time, and certainly it at times has adopted a kind of civilizing mission where it seeks to influence its neighbors either indirectly or directly through a form of colonial rule. So one way to kind of think about it and hear China's expansion into the South China Sea is, I think, quite apt, is that we're reaching a period of China's increasing kind of global engagement. It's seeking to shore up its influence in Asia, to expand out its zone of influence, in South China Sea is a great example there, and then to exert, increasingly its influence in places like Australia, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, and even, further afield over time. So I think, again, it's really important to look at the history of China. It's long and complex, and it's got some episodes of great contribution, as I mentioned, to human history, but it's also got some blights on its record as well.
James, you mentioned there the influence that China is attempting to exert in Australia. Can you outline some of the more covert and underhand ways that China is trying to influence Australia, and maybe even touch on the work of the United Front that takes place?
Yeah, well, the Chinese Communist Party has a really long history of espionage and influence peddling, as do other countries. I mean, this is not something that China does alone. But I think from the very beginning, and it's part of the story of how the CCP came to power, it was through, the manipulation of people, through what is known as United Front work. And United Front work is all about, co-opting potential friends and marginalizing and eventually eliminating any potential enemies. And, the first United Front was an alliance with the Chinese Nationalist Party of Jiang Jiaxi. And they practiced at this for many years before eventually coming to power in 1949. And ever since the founding of the People's Republic of China, there's been this really important department of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party called the United Front Work Department. It's an enormous body that works across a whole range of different policy areas, from dealing with ethnic minorities to Christians to Hong Kong to Taiwan and, of course, overseas Chinese. The thing about the United Front Work Department, though, is its operatives don't carry name cards, they work from the shadows. They're experts at working from the shadows. I'll give you a really concrete example of its kind of covert operation here. It has a branch office in Australia that goes by the name of the Australian Council for the Promotion of Peaceful Reunification, so a real mouthful. So this council calls itself a non-governmental body that is, promoting the interests of the overseas Chinese community here in Australia, but it reports directly back to the United Front Work Department and, is doing its bidding here, on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party here in Australia. And its current head has been in the media quite a bit recently, and there have been reports that ASIO has him as a person of interest.
This is quite shocking. This is all new to me listening to you now, James. And obviously, everybody's focused on Russia and the influence they exerted on the 2016 US election. But clearly, we should be worried about China as well. How concerned are you about China's covert influence in Australia today? And as a follow-up, what's their agenda?
Yeah, I'm obviously quite concerned, hence my willingness to speak out on this issue. But, it's complicated. As I said, all countries do this. Everyone's in the spy game, including Australia, so that's important to note. It's also important to note that the way in which China does it is slightly different. They operate through a whole range of both kind of community organizations as well as sort of outlets that are linked indirectly and directly to the Chinese Communist Party. So you have organizations like the Chinese Students and Scholar Association, the Australia-China Friendship Society. Of course, you have a whole range of Confucius Institutes at our universities. They exert influence through the Chinese language media. And then you have the network of consulates across Australia that we know are quite active in promoting the party's interests, both in politics as well as in universities and in the business sector. What is the aim of this? Well, again, like all countries, China is seeking to advance its national interests. But in this case, I would say the distinction is it's the interests of the Chinese Communist Party, which I said is it's an authoritarian regime that represents, has a membership of only 86 million people. And, it's seeking to maximize its wealth and influence and, now is increasingly powerful and has the ability now to reach further afield. Here in Australia, we need to be very cognizant of that influence, and we need to guard against it through a whole range of things I could go into if you want me to talk about what some of the things we could do.
Yeah, sure. Maybe before we go into that, you mentioned that you were a bit hesitant speaking out, although you have obviously shown a lot of courage in speaking out thus far. But what potential backlash were you concerned about in speaking out against this influence by the Chinese government?
Yeah, well, I've been told by a number of good friends and colleagues that I should be very careful about what I say in a public setting due to concerns about being sued for libel. In fact, my wife was one of the first people who said that. She's a lawyer by training, and there is a history which obviously comes out in the Allen and Unwin decision about Clive Hamilton's book of people in the Chinese Australian community suing people for libel, which of course is their right to do that, and a lot of these things are still playing out in the courts. But put that aside, I think all of us need to be very careful about the words we use. And I think very carefully about the words I use when I talk about this topic and do my research more generally. But I also am one of the other things that a lot of academics worry about, which might be a little bit different from, say, journalists, is about access to the People's Republic of China to continue to do one's research. That is a pressure point that they can bring to bear. Colleagues of mine have been blacklisted and denied visas to visit China, and that can have implications for one's research and one's career. And so, again, that's something that often can lead to, at least amongst academics, to self-censorship or staying away from the sensitive topics. Now, my main research on China is looking at ethnic minority policy conflict as it relates to Xinjiang and Tibet, and those are highly sensitive topics. If I'm to get into trouble, I suspect I'm probably more likely to be for that research than talking about Chinese influence here in Australia. But, you know, this has also become a highly politicized topic. But, you know, because it's so politicized and so important, I think it's really important for people to speak out and for us to have a kind of open and frank national discussion about this issue. And to bring more voices in. I wish there were more people talking about this, both on the kind of positive side and the negative side. You know, we need to have all opinions kind of aired on this really important issue, because really we're at an important turning point in the history of Australia.
The presenting sponsor of the Jolly Swagman podcast is Globite.
Hit their website right now and check out the new Heritage Collection. They have some awesome carry-on luggage items. The orange is a favourite of mine. And also some wicked travel wallets as well.
I assume when you say orange, you mean like a colour of an item, not a piece of fruit you can take on your trip in case you get scurvy.
Yeah, interesting point. They were still giving out travel products when scurvy was a problem though.
Globite was. What a historic company. Glad that we're joining them on their journey. Get on their website. Put in the code SWAGMAN.
And get 15% off any item that you purchase, especially now during the click frenzy bonanza.
Globite.
You go.
We go. Let's talk about the example of Clive Hamilton. Last week, his publisher, Allen and Unwin, ditched a book on Chinese Communist Party influence in Australian politics and academia. And the book was to be titled Silent Invasion, How China is Turning Australia into a Puppet State. Clive, obviously a well-known Australian public intellectual and professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University down in Melbourne, where you are, James, he had this book abandoned by the publisher because they were fearful of potential libel or legal backlash by the Chinese Communist Party or its proxies. What do you think this case means for Australia, and how do you view it? Is it a turning point for us in our relations with China?
Well, to my knowledge, it's the first time that a book that's about China, that's critical about China, has ever been censored outside of China itself. So the Chinese Communist Party has a very extensive censorship regime. Just this earlier this year, it was announced that Cambridge University Press was censoring one of its key journals, the China Quarterly, inside of China, so that the Great Firewall was blocking some articles, mainly that related to Taiwan, Xinjiang, or Tibet. And then a month or so ago, it came out that Springer Nature, which is a large commercial publisher, was doing the same thing, censoring about 1%, at least 1% of its academic articles inside of China. And so with the case of Clive's book, we have the first example of a book that was going to be published outside of China by publisher Allen and Unwin that, to my knowledge, doesn't have a great exposure to the China market. But they did this largely out of a fear of being tied up in a libel suit because of some of the content of the book and concern about a couple libel cases that are currently before the Australian courts. You know, and they made a commercial decision. I think that commercial decision is regrettable, but we've got the situation now with China's rising economic and political might that sometimes we're kind of dancing at shadows, and people are worried about things that may not be something, you know, that will eventuate. You know, that they're being overly cautious, I guess you could say. Rather than standing up for what I think, publishers should, good quality research and opinions that will contribute to our body of knowledge. So it's regrettable, and I'm hopeful that Clive will find another publisher for his book, because it's an important book and it's an important contribution to this national conversation that we are having about China and about China's influence here in Australia.
James, even today it's come out in the media that George Brandis is putting forward amendments to the Espionage Act to tighten or eliminate foreign donations in the political process, and also bring in a US-style foreign agents register, because he says that it's, quote, getting worse, that is foreign interference at a covert level in Australia. Before we finish then, what are some practical steps going forward that you believe Australia should implement to try and combat the growing Chinese influence in Australian life?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think it's really important to begin by noting the fact that, you know, we can't turn our back on China. That would be disastrous for our economy, disastrous for, you know, all Australians. You know, China's here. It's not coming soon. We need to find a way to have a productive relationship, a mature relationship with China, one that kind of carefully weighs up what's at stake in our deep engagement with China. And so I guess the first thing that we need to do, which we are already doing, is have a national conversation about what's at stake and talk through in a rational, you know, evidence-based way the implications of all aspects of our relationship with China.
James, can I interrupt you there before you go on? What would a national conversation look like? Because it's sort of a trope that everyone suggests, but what would the details, what would the conversants in that conversation be in your ideal?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing that now. I mean, we've been engaged in that over the last year. I mean, we've been talking about China, for a long time. But I think for the first time, we've started to look at some of the vulnerabilities of a close engagement with China. And I think that's really positive. I mean, we're doing that here through this podcast, raising awareness. And as I said before, we need to make sure that we have more voices. I mean, I think the biggest voice that's missing is that of Chinese people from the Chinese Australian community. They tend to be generally reticent to talk about this issue publicly. I think we need to find ways to draw them out. If I can make a small plug, Vision Times, which is one of our last remaining free independent Chinese language media group, recently put out a English language special issue that included a number of contributions by people from the Chinese community. And some of the things I have to say are, you know, quite frankly, quite concerning about the way the party is attempting to excise influence on the community and try to co-opt it in ways that I think are really dangerous for our democracy. The Chinese Australian community is quite divided now. There's now over a million people of Chinese ancestry here in Australia, and about half of those, about 500,000, were born and educated inside the People's Republic of China. To be frank, many of them have a different set of values and a different experience and worldview than the majority of Australians, in my opinion. And we need to do a better job of talking with them and trying to convince them. You know, ultimately, it's a game of trying to win over friends and, the same thing that the United Front the Work Department tries to do, and try to convince them that, you know, our values that we hold dear here in Australia are ones that they should adopt as people who are calling Australia their home. So that's another thing that we need to do. We need to find a way to kind of further engage with the Chinese community here in Australia, both the wider community as well as the students at our universities. We need to strengthen some of our existing laws that you were talking about. I understand that these laws will be brought forward before the end of the year to introduce the Foreign Agents Registration Act that already exists in the United States, which I think is a good development. We need to try to find a way to kind of diversify our economy. That's a hard one, but geez, you know, any company that found themselves overly reliant on a single customer would be looking to do the same thing, and I think we need to do that as well. And, you know, I think most importantly, I think we have to be willing to put our principles and values at the forefront of our interactions with China. And yes, that might mean at times that it comes to at the detriment of our financial bottom line. But, you know, I want to live, you know, I very much value our democracy here, our free press, freedom of speech, and open and transparent society. And I'm not willing personally to trade any of those away for extra couple dollars in my pay packet.
And as you said at the start, it's important to distinguish during that conversation the difference between the Chinese people and the Communist Party of China. I think that's it's an easy shoot down for people who are trying to silence the debate to label people xenophobic or racist.
Exactly. I think that's a really important point. And, you know, we had to be upfront about the fact that racism and xenophobia, particularly as directed against Chinese people, is part of our national story. You know, there's a deep vein of racism that runs throughout our history. And, you know, and it's still part of us today. I mean, just look around the issues around asylum seekers, the way we talk about Muslims here in Australia, and now Chinese. But, you know, so we have to be upfront about that, acknowledge that, you know, deal with that. But at the same time, we can't allow it to shut down discussion. You know, I've had many of my critics have, you know, played the race card in order to try to silence me. But, you know, I'm not deterred. I believe, you know, we got to carry out kind of rational conversation on this. I mean, Twitter is perhaps not the best place to do that, but, you know, podcasts like this and programs like the one that we had at La Trobe Asia recently, you know, these are great forums. And we just need to, you know, find, you know, sometimes I do worry that the current debate is a bit lopsided. We're not getting enough voices from those who some of my critics, people in the business community have been largely absent from this debate. And as I said before, the people in the Chinese community haven't spoken out enough. You know, we really need to look at all different points of view on this so we can come to an informed decision as a country about how we go forward.
James Leibold, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure, boys. And it was great chatting with you, and great to see the podcast. It's an important contribution to the media landscape here in Australia. So keep it up.
Thank you. Will do.
Thanks for listening, everyone, to another week on the Jolly Swagman podcast. We hope you enjoyed our chat with James Leibold, and we hope we didn't scare you too much.
If you have any questions that you want us to ask guests, whether it's people who appeared on the property special, whether it's James Leibold himself, send them in. Send them in. We'll ask them. We'll put them to these people. So our website is www.thejollyswagmen, that's men, M-E-N, .com, and hit us up on the Contact Us page.
Or you can always hit us up on Twitter at jollyswagmanpod. To give us your feedback and ask any questions. So, Joe, I'll see you next week when I'm back in the country. But until then,
ciao.
See you then.